Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and with me here is Liz Martin. Hello, Liz.
Hello.
You've done quite a few episodes recently, haven't you?
Yes, I have been doing quite a few.
And who've you interviewed this time?
This time I was talking to Professor John Hutchinson from the Royal Veterinary College in London.
And where did you do this interview?
This was at the Paleontological Association annual meeting in Cardiff. I guess that was a couple of weeks ago. When was that?
Before Christmas.
Yeah, about a month ago.
There was just a big blur of alcohol and food
in
between.
Yeah, I can't really remember past all of the food and everything else that happened in the last month.
And speaking of food, you were in the cafe, weren't you? You managed to grab John, because wasn't he the keynote speaker as well?
Yeah, so he was doing the annual address, and I managed to grab him during one of the talk sessions in the cafe. So we kind of sat down and had a chat.
All about biomechanics.
Yes, about biomechanics and locomotion.
And he did a lot of stuff for Jurassic Park, didn't he? Have I made that up?
I think he's done a little bit, not a significant amount, but a little bit.
Whoops.
I'm trying to remember, though. We didn't talk about that at all, so I could be entirely wrong.
I could be entirely wrong as well. I think I've just given him a credit in Jurassic Park. But that's the kind of service you get here at PaleoCast.
I think he'd do something, but I'm not sure how much.
Anyway, if you managed to catch a live stream of the conference, I hope you enjoyed that. And the videos that I made will be available very soon. So conference streaming, recording and reporting are just some of the things that we do here at PaleoCast. We don't get paid for this, so everyone who contributes to the show does so voluntarily. We got two grants when we first started out in 2012, which covered our initial costs when we set up. But then we've had nothing since. So we're therefore asking for your help in covering some of the costs of the show. Not so much the hosting of the website or the audio, but the purchase of new and replacement equipment, software, and helping us to get to more events like Palace. So we've therefore added a donate button to the website, which if you're feeling generous, you can gift us with any amount you see fit. Don't worry, if not, PaleoCast will always be free and we'll never put ads in. This is what this is all about. We don't want to compromise the quality of your listening experience, but just make it better. And that's really all the airtime that I'll ever want to give to our finances. So sorry to John that we stuck it into the intro to his episode. But this really is a fantastic interview. I learned a lot about biomechanics. I really enjoyed editing this one, actually, which I never really enjoy editing anything. But I had a good listen, and I hope you enjoy this as well.
It was a really fun episode for me to do, so I hope you like it. And please let us know what you think. Thank you for joining us, John. You're now based at the Royal Veterinary College at the University of London, working on different groups of animals and biomechanics. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into biomechanics?
Sure, yeah. I did an undergraduate degree at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, which is in the Midwest of the U.S., and that degree was in zoology, but I started off interested in marine biology. My father was a bacterial geneticist. I had studied invertebrates a little bit, but then after seeing Jurassic Park and reading the book and taking some other classes, I just kind of blundered, I guess you could say, into vertebrate studies and decided that's what I wanted to do for my PhD, and managed to do that with Kevin Padian as my supervisor at the University of California, Berkeley. Then did a National Science Foundation fellowship in mechanical engineering at Stanford University nearby. And then finally in 2003 ended up at the Royal Vet College, where I've been since, and now I'm a professor.
The first question, I guess, for our listeners especially is, can you explain what exactly is biomechanics?
Yeah, so biomechanics, the way I see it, is that it's almost not a field, or it is only loosely. It's really a tool or a set of techniques or a perspective in which we simply apply usually fairly simple mechanics like Newtonian mechanics or physics to organisms to try to understand how they work. That's really it in a nutshell, biomechanics.
Most of your work, at least now, is based on modern animals. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the modern animals you've worked with and what you've sort of learned about them that's different from what we knew about them in the past?
Yeah, so I guess it's helpful to take a historical approach that I started off doing a PhD that was originally focused on T-Rex, but then I decided, well, in order to understand T-Rex, I need to understand all the animals it's related to, take a phylogenetic approach, an evolutionary approach to understanding how the form of its ancestors evolved. So that required me to understand living animals, and ever since then I've appreciated, especially my background being in neontology or biology more than paleo somewhat, I appreciate that we need to contribute data on living animals. That's extremely important. And that moves both paleo and neontology fields forward to do that. It's a win-win situation to contribute data on living animals. So I try to keep a foot firmly planted in paleo because I like the macroevolutionary comparative emphasis. But in order to keep that foot there, you also need that other foot there in neontology because the two reciprocally illuminate each other. And that's why I still maintain a lot of research, also being at a vet college where there's a lot of living animal research, and I'm the black sheep who's the only one who studies fossils. Yeah, that's really the way it has to be.
So what sort of modern animals have you looked at to specifically understand extinct animals or extinct locomotion?
Oh my goodness. I have studied so many living animals, I could never count. But the major animals I've studied that I'm known for studying especially are elephants. I'd started studying them when I was a grad student as kind of a side project because I wanted to understand how does the largest living land animal work. I realized from looking at the literature that no one knew. There was almost no study of that animal or either species. So elephants have been a big focus. And also during my PhD, I also started working on crocodiles and their locomotion pretty intensively. And then birds in general, broadly, I've been working on since I was doing my PhD, all kinds of birds, especially kind of basal running type birds, because most of my research is on legs and terrestrial locomotion, not so much flight or other things.
That was going to be my next question. Have you done anything on the flight, or what about swimming? Have you worked anything in water?
Only just kind of touched on swimming a little bit in like seals. We did a paper with Stephanie Pierce about 4 years ago, and now working on early tetrapods. We certainly are, because we're looking at the water to land transition there, how animals first got onto land and used their bony limbs to walk around. You thus do need to have some appreciation for fluid mechanics and how swimming works. So I'm no stranger to those areas, but it's not a big focus of my research right now. Flight, swimming, any kind of fluid dynamics, or for that matter, feeding. I tend to focus on things that involve locomotion on land and the postcranial skeleton and musculature and so forth.
Can you go into a little bit more detail about how these modern animals can really tell us about the locomotion of the extinct thing, like specifically what it is you're looking at?
So I take a couple of perspectives. One is that living animals, regardless to a degree of what species you look at, can be used to validate the techniques that we apply to extinct animals. So we can build a computer model of an extinct animal, and that's great. We can make it really fancy and mathematically rigorous and so forth, but we don't know how well it works until we apply that same technique to a living animal where we know how it works, and then we can compare the output of the model to known data, like experimental data or whatever. That has always been a big focus of my research since my PhD days, the validation approach. But then also, I want to understand evolution, and living animals are part of that evolution. So by studying a bird or a crocodile, we get two kind of endpoints in the case of those two species, whichever species you choose within those two clades, forms a point of reference by which you can begin to look back, kind of backtrack through evolution, look at homologous traits, traits that have been inherited from a common ancestor, and go back through evolution to a common ancestor like the common ancestor of crocodiles and birds and dinosaurs and so forth, the ancestral archosaur, if you will. Mm. By backtracking homologous traits, you can reconstruct how living animals came to be the way they are, what made them different from other living animals or extinct animals, as well as what features did extinct animals share with living animals, what primitive or derived traits were there in certain extinct animals, what was the sequence of character acquisition or the acquisition of new traits, how did those get assembled, more or less. That's a very big focus of mine, and living animals are incredibly important for that.
You've mentioned looking at homologous traits and tracing those back, but how do you deal with anything that's analogous? How can you look at the biomechanics or kind of function of something that isn't present in any modern animals? Have you done anything like that?
Yeah, that's certainly harder. So things like plesiosaur swimming or pterosaur flight, for that matter, get difficult because you're looking at convergence, and therefore form and function are not the same, almost by definition, or at least it's risky to assume that they are. So it's important, I think, even more so than to have some kind of validation. You need to look at some other analogous organism that at least loosely works similarly, or you would think that it might, and see if you can reconstruct how that animal works and do so accurately. I think that's powerful. Or looking at it from a kind of standard convergence standpoint, that if you keep seeing the same grossly qualitatively similar features evolving again and again and again, it's pretty reasonable to assume that to some degree they worked in similar ways if they faced similar constraints. So the wings of bats and birds and pterosaurs are broadly agreed to have generally similar functions at a certain level. And that's valuable. The more you discover that and test that assumption, almost, of analogy, that analogous or convergent traits work the same way, the more confident you become in that assumption, and the more safely you can apply that to other systems. So let's say we discovered a fourth clade of winged vertebrates. If we knew that to what degree and where bird, bat, and pterosaur wings work similarly, if we knew that quite confidently, we could then apply those principles to that fourth clade of winged vertebrates and reconstruct how they moved and evolved better, probably. In my own research, if you don't mind me interjecting, I look a lot at giant land animals and how gravity is a fundamental constraint on how land animals work. So, yeah, looking at an elephant or a T-Rex or a big crocodile or an ostrich, big animals, relatively or absolutely speaking, and how they handle their weight on land, we begin to understand the fundamental principles that constrain what kinds of things animals are able to do on land. That in particular, as you get bigger, athletic abilities inevitably decline, and at very extreme sizes, relatively or absolutely, animals begin to lose the ability to do certain behaviors. This happens during evolution, but it can also happen even during the ontogeny of certain organisms. Animals generally, as they get larger during growth, begin to shed abilities, either in a relative sense, becoming slower, less athletic, or in an absolute sense, even losing a whole gait as they get bigger. Like in crocodiles, it's pretty clear that giant crocodiles can't bound or gallop or use asymmetrical gaits that smaller crocodiles can do. So there's a good example of that.
That ties in nicely with what I was trying to figure out how to ask, but thinking about dinosaurs, of course, you've done a fair bit of work on dinosaurs in the past, but would you say it's more important to look at kind of larger things like elephants, and you're talking about looking at the largest land animals today, or is it more important to look at closely related species, like such as birds? Or is it kind of a combination of the two?
I think you advance the most, certainly, by a combination of the two. Of course, that's harder. You spread yourself more thin by doing that. But looking only at ostriches, we certainly could understand ostriches very well but that would tell us very little about T-Rex, for example, just focusing intensively on ostriches or elephants or whatever. And these analogies are very limited often. I find them to be risky to a certain degree because the way evolution works is that analogies always at some level fall apart and no longer inform you. And to some degree can be dead ends, that once you've found that, oh, an elephant and a sauropod are similar in some way in terms of their locomotion, where does that lead you further? It kind of stops at that point once you've concluded, oh, they're similar. It's more interesting maybe to ask, how are they not similar, or how did their evolution proceed, or what constraints govern their locomotion fundamentally? Mm. Or did they face the same constraints and the same muscles, the same joints? Were they constrained in the same ways or differently in some ways? Probably so.
Is there a certain aspect of kind of dinosaur biomechanics that you are particularly interested in? Is it just kind of general dinosaur locomotion, or is there a specific group that you think is the most interesting to look at?
I certainly have long had a theropod dinosaur bias because, all right, yeah, there's interesting size range there, and they're bipedal, so there's a generally similar body plan and behavior. Bipedalism is far simpler than quadrupedalism. Mm. Once you have four legs interacting with a substrate, it becomes more than twice as difficult as looking at two-legged animals. And they evolved into birds, so there's an interesting macroevolutionary connection. But yeah, sauropods are interesting. I think there's a broad assumption that they were all kind of the same once they became quadrupedal and big, and I don't believe in that assumption, that in terms of quadrupedal locomotion, there's enough evidence that there was a lot of diversity in that group that's kind of been brushed under the carpet often. Even as far as like the elephant analogy goes, were all sauropods constrained to walk like an elephant? Maybe not. Maybe there were some major differences there in different groups. I think that's interesting, but still a big unanswered question to me is how dinosaurs became bipedal in the first place. That still is really hazy. And what other animals became bipedal? What were the benefits of being bipedal? Trade-offs, so forth. That's interesting. Origin of flight, yeah, I mean, I'm working on that with some other people a little bit. It's not a major interest of mine, and to some degree I still feel like it's somewhat unsolvable, or people agree more than they admit they do. Too much splitting into this stupid arboreal cursorial dichotomy that should be long dead. But anyway, I'm heading on a tangent there and a rant that I probably should avoid.
Looking back on the origin of bipedalism in dinosaurs, I think that sort of the current thought is that the earliest dinosaurs were bipedal.
To some degree. But it's not clear that that was the ancestral condition for all dinosaurs, or whether it was some sort of facultative bipedalism. Because if you look at it from an outgroup perspective, phylogenetically, you get all sorts of things that are either ambiguous or quadrupedal or clearly bipedal around the dinosaurian ancestor. So early ornithischians, yeah, mostly or all bipedal. Early theropods, yes, pretty much all bipedal. Early sauropodomorphs, probably all bipedal. But then when you go to like psilosaurids and pterosaurs, of course, and other things outside of dinosauria, it gets gray.
Yeah.
And some things we just don't know well enough, like Lagerpeton, we have hind limbs there, but what were its forelimbs like? Until you know the forelimbs of an animal, it's really hard to establish bipedality in that particular taxon.
So would you be more interested at looking at kind of that outgroup, like before that whole group evolved, or at specifically kind of basal dinosauromorphs?
I think the whole transition I'm interested in from dinosauromorphs into dinosaurs would be fascinating, and if the funding gods are kind, I might be able to do that, but if not, well, that's life.
You mentioned before that in your PhD you worked on T-Rex, and I think you did some work on kind of how fast of a runner T-Rex was. Can you talk a little bit about that study and how you were able to determine its running speed.
Yeah, so that was really the focus of my PhD. When I first interviewed to do a PhD, I said I want to test Jurassic Park et al.'s idea that T-Rex could run quickly using biomechanics, using computer models like I had seen people do at Berkeley where I did my PhD. But first I had to reconstruct the musculature of T-Rex, and I spent most of my PhD actually doing that, looking phylogenetically at all of reptiles, including birds, really, and then moving up to T-Rex and reconstructing its musculature from a phylogenetic perspective. But then, ultimately, toward the end of my PhD, I got into doing some simple biomechanics, building very, very simple 2D kind of stick figure models of a T-Rex leg frozen in mid-step, and using pretty well worked out simple methods to estimate how big would the leg muscles of a T-Rex need to be to support itself at the middle of a running step when the forces are highest. And then comparing those forces to how much musculature a T-Rex might have had compared to other living animals, and also testing the method with living animals, so seeing if we apply this method to ostriches and small birds that do run bipedally, does the model predict they could? Does a human able to run bipedally according to the model? Yes. And then is a alligator or crocodile able to? They don't, and they're not able to according to the model, so you get kind of negative validation there. That was very satisfying to do all that. And then in my postdoc at Stanford, I got to apply more and more sophisticated computer technology to this problem, getting into 3D methods to look in more detail at particular aspects of the anatomy, like how big certain muscles were, what their leverage was like. And that has continued throughout my research ever since, as well as looking in finer and finer detail at birds and crocodiles and so forth, and really trying to understand how do they work, because we still don't understand a lot about them.
So if I remember correctly, you found that T-Rex was not very fast.
Oh,
you thought
yeah,
it was a slower one.
I failed at SciComm there and didn't answer your question. Yeah,
no, it's okay.
T-Rex,
one, so.
I found with my co-author Mariano Garcia. This was a career-making paper in Nature in 2002 that showed that it could not run quickly. How quickly? Well, no faster than maybe 15-25 miles per hour.
Okay.
And a big focus of that study was to acknowledge that there's a lot we don't know about T-Rex in terms of its anatomy and musculature and so forth. And that was as much as we could at the time factored into those models, and it didn't really matter. Regardless of how we reconstructed T-Rex, we couldn't find a solution that would allow it to run really, really fast and sustain the very high forces that are involved in running very quickly, like 40, 45 miles an hour, which some paleontologists had claimed very vociferously was certainly the case.
Some more recent papers have suggested it is a little bit faster than what you found. I don't know if it's as fast as that.
No, I don't think anyone has clearly claimed that.
I thought that it was T-Rex, but maybe it was other theropods, because I know there was some work done at my old university at U of A looking at the tail musculature.
Yeah, none of that has predicted a speed, though. All the other work has shown, okay, there are interesting features in tyrannosaurs or other animals that are maybe more extreme than in other animals, but none of those directly have a connection mechanistically to this is how fast it ran, which is what my work did to a certain degree. There have been really good research projects done by people at Manchester, like Bill Sellers and Carl Bates and others, where they did pretty fancy computer simulations that did directly predict a speed. And those are important contributions that have broadly agreed with what I've found and haven't really shown anything, to my understanding, that suggests something majorly different from what I suggested.
Okay.
They shed some more light on things and are important, but so far I think broadly this is the consensus that T-Rex may have been able to run at moderate speeds, maybe even 25 miles an hour, who knows, but... No one has convincingly made an argument that goes back to the mechanisms that govern motion and the physics of motion that show, yes, a T-Rex must have been able to run 40 miles an hour or something. I think I found in this work, there's an emotional component to this, that people really want T-Rex to be fast. Yeah. And certainly the reaction at the time when I published the work 13 years ago saying that wasn't fast was from certain circles, disappointment and anger to a really disturbing degree, saying, well, you've hurt my favorite animal and I'll never forgive you. And that's just strange because, yeah, I'd be fine if someone could make a convincing, objective argument based on data that showed that a big two-legged dinosaur could run really quickly. That would be fascinating. I'd celebrate that. Mm. That would be progress. That's the way science works. I wouldn't take it personally. The science just needs to be done right. And there are many, many, many missteps in this kind of work that you can do. And maybe I've done them, I don't know. I don't think so, or else I'd quickly admit it, but it's easy to go wrong in this field and build a very sexy-looking computer model, for example, that actually tells you nothing because it's fundamentally flawed.
Yeah. Does that have anything to say about kind of whether or not T-Rex was an active predator, you know, the old debate about predator versus scavenger, which isn't really a debate, but...
No, you're going to make me vomit. I hate it. I hate it.
So it could still easily be an active predator while not running 40 miles an hour.
I think there is no controversy there. Yeah. Even, like, Jack Horner and stuff has long since agreed that this was just kind of... The scavenger idea was just thrown out there to piss people off because he knew T-Rex ate his duckbills, just like... everyone else knew this, and it was both scavenger and predator. Get over it. Move on. Just like any carnivore, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, it does relate to the ecology, certainly. That it's a very interesting question. What was the pace of the Hell Creek formation's ecosystem like? Was it a really rapid pace, kind of like the Serengeti, where animals were going 40, 50 miles an hour, sprinting across the open plains there to catch each other, 7-ton monsters pounding across the plains, or was it more of a more sedate kind of thing? Although, if we're talking 25 miles an hour, that's still going to be pretty darn impressive, and the difference between 25 and 40 miles an hour is not that much, but this is science. We want to do things right. We want to have an accurate representation of animal behavior in the past, and it would be the most pleasing if we could all agree that that was based on firm scientific evidence that anyone could do and replicate and so forth.
Is there anything kind of similar that's been done with the sort of herbivores of those same ecosystems where people have looked at how fast could a hadrosaur run versus a T-Rex to see if they could, if they were sort of similar?
So the only study that's been done that really is that kind of mechanistic study like I was talking about is, again, by Bill Sellers' group, where they did a simulation of a young Camptosaurus and showed that, it could run, and maybe it would have been faster quadrupedally, which fits some ideas. That was a pretty interesting study, but that's not simulating an Edmontosaurus, like a 7-ton animal. That's more like an 800-kilogram animal.
Okay.
So very different from, and from a very different time from T-Rex.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think we would expect Edmontosaurus, Triceratops to be around the same speed and probably statistically indistinguishable from a T-Rex in terms of speed.
Okay.
Especially given the unknowns in this, there's no way you're going to be able to pin down a T-Rex could move 27.3 miles per hour and an Edmontosaurus could move 29.5 miles per hour, and therefore that's how they got away. That's how they did it.
Yeah.
We'll never get there. Never, ever, 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 ever. I'll go that far, that confidently, that there's just too much unknown.
Yeah, I was just thinking that I've heard very few studies on sort of the biomechanics of the locomotion of the more quadrupedal, like hadrosaurs and ceratopsians and stuff, possibly because people really like theropods, so they do a lot of work on theropods.
Well, there's been good work by Paul Barrett and Susie Maidment that has gone in that direction with Carl Bates from the Manchester group.
Yeah.
I think some of that is unpublished, but they've set the stage for doing those kind of things. I think that whole area of predicting dinosaur speeds and so forth is not far from kind of running out of steam.
Yeah.
You know, there's only so many exciting questions there with dinosaur speed to ask before it's like, okay, we're doing another dinosaur. It's got the same degree of uncertainty as everything else before it had, and they're all kind of a muddle to a certain degree. And it's really only the giant ones that you can test much with conclusively, because they're up against the extremes and really pushing themselves to the limits. With a like a 20 kilogram dinosaur, you're going to find that it could be pretty darn fast regardless, no matter almost what species it was, and probably would had a hard you'd have a hard time distinguishing any medium, small to medium sized dinosaurs in terms of locomotor performance. It's easier to test what behaviors a bigger animal might not have been possible of doing, capable of doing.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about some of the stuff you did with early tetrapods? You mentioned before that you've done a little bit, just kind of moving into other fossil animals.
This is a really fun project that I've done since, 2009 with Jenny Clack at Cambridge and Stephanie Pierce now at Harvard. And Julia Molnar was part of that project as well. Since moved back to America, she did a PhD with me on tetrapods and crocodiles. Anyway, we got some NERC funding, NERC, twice, surprisingly, to look at the problem of how early tetrapods from the Devonian and thenceforth might have walked or not walked on land. And we did some really cool 3D modeling of Ichthyostega in particular, and some new stuff yet to come out on Acanthostega and other animals, Peterpes, other Devonian Carboniferous tetrapods, to see what they were capable of doing. And that's really broadly applying the same kind of approaches that we had applied with T-Rex, although in this case it really starts with 3D anatomy. And we first looked at what were the ranges of joint motion that the limbs could do in Ichthyostega, and found that it could not have moved its limbs, especially its hind limbs, in a way that would have worked to support it on land.
Okay.
That if it did walk on land, and it probably could move a bit on land, it probably had to mostly use its forelimbs, and probably using its forelimbs together in kind of a crutching motion synchronously, like a mud skipper or a sea turtle or something like that. So that was a fun study that we did. That was, back in 2012 or so. And we've been carrying on since then. Again, going back to this validation principle and trying to test these computer approaches with living animals, looking at salamanders in particular, and also looking at other extinct tetrapods, moving along the phylogenetic tree up towards amphibians to see, well, how did locomotion evolve if the first tetrapods, like probably Acanthostega as well as Ichthyostega and a few other things, if they were moving in this kind of crudely mudskipper-like gait, barely able to pull themselves along land very well, when did modern walking and running like a salamander evolve?
Yeah.
That still is ambiguous. There are footprints and other lines of evidence that indicate it probably didn't take long for that to settle in. So certainly once you get to what we call crown group tetrapods, the common ancestor of amphibians and amniotes, mammals, birds, all that, at that point onwards, by some point in the Carboniferous, you had pretty modern locomotion, but there's still a big gap there in between Ichthyostega-style shuffling locomotion and modern walking and running, and plenty of fossils to fill in that gap, and that's what we're trying to do now.
Are there a lot of fossils that are complete enough from that time that can help you with it?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful, wonderful fossil record, thanks to Jenny Clack and Per Alberg and many others. Mm. Oh, my God. And it just keeps getting better and better. It's really exciting. And so much untested there. So it's just got me so excited early on to be working on this project where everything you did was new. No one had applied biomechanics really at all to this situation, whereas in dinosaurs, now it's like overcrowded, everyone's doing it. It's it's kind of, like I said, it's kind of running out of big questions, whereas there in early tetrapods and in many other groups, there are big questions left to be resolved that have serious importance, paleobiologically and macroevolutionarily.
It's really crazy to think that they that nobody has looked at that group, considering how important they are in tetrapod evolution.
Yeah, like, I think partly it's because of the fossil record that until the 80s and 90s, we had Ichthyostega, which was sitting in some drawers in Copenhagen with Jarvik lording over them until the 90s, mostly. And not a lot of people studying those. And we had Eriops, and we had Eusthenopteron. Mm. But that was about it. There were some fragments of Acanthostega and other things, but there was a pretty big gap, except for Ichthyostega, between lobe-finned fish and modern amphibians, basically. Eriops, a big frogamander kind of thing, is kind of the worst model for the ancestor of modern amphibians possible, because it's so big, so chunky, and still pretty anatomically different from a modern amphibian, that as an endpoint to bracket the evolution of walking and running, it's pretty poor. It's so specialized. It's an interesting animal. It'd be great to study it, but those giant temnospondyls were very, very weird.
You've talked a lot so far about computer modeling and various different sort of technological advancements.
Yeah.
Have those really sort of revolutionized how we do biomechanics today?
Yeah. So if you look at our great mentor and role model, R. McNeil Alexander's work in the 70s and 80s and early 90s, it's all very simple math.
Yeah.
Simple equations, simple two-dimensional line drawings, basically, or plastic toy models from museums. We can kind of laugh at it now, but back then it was groundbreaking. It was amazing. And no one had really done anything before then. It was from the 70s onwards. He was almost the only person doing anything, but still very, very simple.
Yeah.
A lot of assumptions, and he talked about them and how much they worried him, that it was a very uncertain science. But then the advent of 3D technologies and the ability to share these kind of anatomical data to test more and more sophisticated hypotheses have led to a blossoming of this field that has really opened up new avenues of research quickly. And it's an exciting time. I wonder how much longer it will last. Even in neglected areas, it's moving fast. In the last 20 years since I started my PhD, it has gone so far and so fast. Not just talking about locomotion, but feeding, breathing. Mm-hmm. This field is moving fast. Not only due to computer stuff. It's not just technology, but also just better knowledge of anatomy, better experiments, testing the links between form and function and behavior. That has been hugely important. Like, my mentor Steve Gatesy had a huge influence on me in convincing me that not only do you need to look at anatomy of animals and do nice 3D stuff with that anatomy of extinct animals, but also you need to test how does a thing work in a living animal before you go back to the fossil record and tell stories about how extinct animals work, because living animals are so complex, they can often surprise you by what they are or are not able to do. And so I've underemphasized that in this interview, really, how important that is. I'm a firm believer in doing lots of experimental, either in vivo or cadaveric work on living animals to test how they work and validate models and so forth.
Well, I know just in some of the work I've done, I've thought to myself, oh, that's a really interesting question. I wonder if that's the case in pterosaurs. Let me see if it is in birds. And then go, there's no literature on it. Like, things that I would expect would be so easily tested or looked at. There's just nothing at all
that
anybody's ever bothered to do. I guess because people just kind of go, oh, well, it's a living animal and we can watch it, so why study these specific things?
Why study the fundamentals, like the morphology, or provide basic data? Yeah, we did a project recently where we were looking at the density of feathers of birds, and we looked back at the literature to try to see, well, can we take any literature values to put into our computer models for how dense feathers would be, like in a microraptor or whatever? Yeah. And there was basically nothing. So we had to start from ground zero and collect our own data. Well, here's measuring some density. Here's what it's like, kind of like what you've done with bones.
Yeah. No, it's really surprising to me how often you try to learn something about a modern animal and discover that nobody has ever done it.
Oh, yeah.
And then how are you supposed to say anything about an extinct animal if we don't even know what modern ones do?
Yeah, unless it's a mouse, a model organism like that, or a domestic species that has a lot of investment and welfare issues and so forth, there probably hasn't been much research on it. I find that again and again and again. I was surprised to see that, for example, with elephants. I thought, well, yeah, we should know a lot about elephants. And
yeah.
I looked and there were like 3 papers and all very qualitative and basic.
Yeah. What kind of stuff, you've mentioned that you've worked on elephants, and I know that you've done a little bit of work, but what sort of stuff have you done with elephants that you can specifically kind of relate back to any of the extinct things or just in general about elephants?
So yeah, we started looking at just the question of what can an elephant do or not do by measuring them. We started working in zoos, got familiar with them, realized they were couch potato elephants, wouldn't really do much, which is not surprising. And then made some contacts in Thailand and found elephants that were basically used for racing and were really athletic. So we went there and worked with them to see, well, what does an elephant do when it's going at top speed, like a racing elephant? Mm. And found very repeatedly that they never went faster than 15 miles an hour or so, these Asian elephants, at any age, any size. They wouldn't do more than that. And then, of course, they never left the ground with all 4 feet. But when they did go fast, they did something really interesting, which was start bouncing and flexing their limbs, bending their limbs more and more and more as they went faster and faster and faster. And we showed very convincingly, I think it's now about as proven as it can get, that they do have 2 gaits, that they have a walking and a running gait that we can objectively identify.
Mm-hmm.
A very stiff-legged walking gait in which the limbs are used like pendula, inverted pendula swinging back and forth, like a toy soldier's kind of gait. Fairly vertical-limbed or columnar, as elephants are often described. But then when elephants speed up, they very gradually transition into a running gait in which they bounce and flex their limbs a lot.
Mm.
And so adopt this fundamentally different kind of behavior that we can identify using biomechanical experimental measurement techniques. The interesting thing about these 2 gaits is that the transition between them is continuous. Unlike there being a discrete walk and run, like when you look at a horse, it shifts from a walk to a run. You can notice it with your eyes very discreetly, the walk to trot transition.
Mm-hmm.
In most cursorial mammals, at least, is very marked, very discreet. But in elephants, and now people are finding in many, many other animals, bipedal and quadrupedal, they don't have a discrete transition. They just blur from a walk to a run as they gradually speed up. And that's really cool. We were one of the first studies to really show that in almost any species. We now know also that birds do this generally, that they lack a discrete gait transition.
Yeah.
Going from a walk to a grounded run to a full-on run, just kind of slurring through those gaits. Generally, it's very hard to identify anything different between a fast walk and a slow grounded run, for example, in a bird. And many other species do this as well, reptiles and so forth. It's not clear now. An interesting question, when did these things evolve? When did discrete gait changes evolve? Maybe that's only a thing that we see in cursorial, upright, larger mammals in particular. And maybe it's lost repeatedly. That is still unresolved.
That's really interesting. Just to kind of wrap up, of course, we've talked a little bit about what you are currently working on and what you're interested in, but can you talk a little bit about what you think the next big thing is, or what your next big thing is, if you can pinpoint one or two?
I should plug our sesamoid bone project
that
we're doing now, which I love. Again, this is an area where we look at the literature, we see very little's been done on it.
Yeah.
Sesamoid bones are bones that form in and around tendons and ligaments, like your kneecap is one of them. So we're looking at the evolution of those, the biomechanics, the development, and so forth. I won't say more about that because I could go on and on. But that's fun. So that's something I'm doing now. And we'll continue all the dinosaur stuff and the elephant stuff. And we look at animal feet and other interesting things. There's a lot of projects going on there that have themes of anatomy and size and evolution and biomechanics and sometimes development. But in terms of bigger things, unresolved questions, I need a moment to think about that. It's hard to flag just one up. I'd like to.
Are there any other big transitions in the fossil record that haven't really been looked at in a biomechanic sense?
I still think pterosaur locomotion in all senses is an interesting mystery.
Yeah.
I think the terrestrial locomotion issues are far from worked out.
Yeah.
And the flight, of course, has some issues left. The origin of their flight is still very mysterious. Mm-hmm. And same would go to a certain degree for bats.
Yeah.
Birds. Yeah, I think it's time to move on. But what about other major behaviors? Yeah, I mean, my main interest fundamentally would be the origin and major transitions in dynamic behaviors that have something to do with the musculoskeletal system and size and, of course, biomechanics. So along those lines, well, all right, I'll go out on a limb a bit. I would say that the big questions left over might be in fish. That swimming, locomotion, and all the amazing adaptations in fish, there's a lot, because there's so much diversity there. There's so much left to be done. Terrestrially moving fish, fast-swimming fish, all that. There's been a lot of research. I'm not saying it's neglected, but there's just so much that could be done still there, especially in a macroevolutionary sense, bring in fossils. I bet there's a lot left to be done. I wouldn't call myself an expert able to point to particular problems there yet, but I think there are cool things that could be done there. And there's surely other problems in extinct vertebrate groups, I guess you could point to notoungulates, weird groups that haven't even been studied much anatomically, let alone functionally or other things. All those, that weird South American radiation of mammals, the notoungulates, or there's a lot left to be done with mammals, I think, in general. A lot of diversity there. Lizards, plenty more can be done there. A lot of work has been done on lizard locomotion, but a lot more could be done. It's not as many giant questions there, I think, as there are in mammals. I mean, most lizards move in pretty similar ways, but there's none of them that are doing as extreme things as in mammals, like flying or evolving 20-ton sizes or whatever. I don't know. Those are some ideas.
Yeah. No, I think that that's great. Thank you very much for joining us, John.
Thank you. That was fun.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall with Joe Keating, Laura Soule and Liz Martin. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, with music supplied by the Ocean Collective. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material for this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
You're actually using Joe's old portable recorder, aren't you, Liz?
Yeah.
From 2012.
Yes, I have not managed to get a new one, but it works all right.
Good. Have you got the H2 or the H4?
I actually currently have both because I stole Joe's H4.
Okay, so we need new equipment because Liz is hoarding it all and collecting it for herself. She wants the whole collection.
Yeah,
we need the H1, we need the H5, and we need the H6. So everyone chip in.